Secure your digital world in physical form with IM8bit. For over 15 years, IM8bit has been crafting premium expansions of the industry's best games, from pioneering community experiences for Epic's Fortnite World Cup to bringing over 100 award-winning soundtracks from breakout hits like Untitled Goose Game and Disco Elysium to vinyl, and bringing the Ori sequel to Switch. Their passion for artistry and gaming fuels them, whether they're interpreting beloved brands from a new point of view or extending the mythology of another game, perhaps one you're developing. What's the IM8bit difference? Their collectibles are premium, but for IM8bit, they're personal too. See for yourself at im8bit.com.
Hi, this is Austin Wintry, and in today's Game Maker's Notebook, I had a very wonderful and atypical chat with a guy named Buzz Burrows. Buzz is an audio programmer, he's not a composer, and he's somewhat of a legend in industry circles. He began his career in games working at Sony, as you'll hear him describe, and developed a lot of the tools and techniques for game audio and interactive music that we essentially take for granted today. He is now the lead audio programmer at Harmonix, and honestly, if you find our conversation half as enthralling as I did, then you will be over the moon. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
All right. Buzz Burrows, how are you, sir?
I am well. Yourself?
You know, I can't complain. I have to say, one of the things that I've loved about doing this podcast is that it's kind of, initially, it gave me occasion to, have a platform to hang out with friends and sort of musical fellow travelers that I've known for most of my career. But as the time has gone on that I've been doing it, it's led to days like today, where I get to meet somebody new who I don't know prior to today and kick over some rocks that we've largely not touched on this show, with so much emphasis on kind of, especially with the ones that I do, the episodes with fellow composers specifically talking about kind of the art of game scoring in a sort of philosophical sense. Your work on the tech side is so underexposed, I think, for this show. So I'm real excited to have you here, and I appreciate you doing this.
Well, sure. Thanks. Look forward to the discussion.
Well, let's just kind of get straight into it. I did a little bit of reading because we hadn't met before. I normally don't do any kind of research, but I thought, well, this will quite literally be our first time. Yeah, I'm excited to kind of know what I don't know, and it seems like we surely have very nearly met, I would think, a bunch of times, just because we have many kind of overlapping circles, and certainly your time with Sony overlaps with time in which I was working with Sony. So, like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there were kind of like shared elevators or something at some point, or a GDC passing. Mm-hmm. But just for due diligence, what's kind of the path that led you to this intersection of tech and music? In your case, you know, some people start on the music side of it and gradually onboard more tech into their diet, and then, or the reverse. So kind of, how did you lay that foundation?
Well, let's see. My background is as an audio recording engineer. So that's kind of was the beginning of my career. I went to Berklee College of Music and graduated with a degree in production engineering, and went out to Hollywood and became a staff engineer at Record Plant Recording Studios, and did that thing for a number of years. I worked on records.
I have to pause you already, because I actually did read your story of actually getting that job at Record Plant. And I just have to kind of tee you up to tell that, because that's just too good. And especially since I think there's a fair number of listeners that are kind of, you know, at a similar place in their career where you were at that point. And it's not only a good story, but I think it's kind of a inspiring story in its way. So if you don't mind indulging me.
Inspiring or in some ways frightening at how random it sometimes seems to be.
But I feel like that's actually a great way to put it, because that's like luck is such an X factor that we all depend on. But, and it's something that all the people that have kind of found their footing professionally, they always have some kind of luck moment. So it always seems like it's about just hanging in there long enough to have that. But what's your record plant story? Because it's just too good.
Well, I graduated and went right out to California, loaded up the van with no job prospect, and headed out with my wife. I got married a couple of weeks after graduating, and she was a production and engineering major as well. So we both went out to California to make our way with no jobs, and spent a few months going to all the recording studios, trying to meet people, taking a resume around. And I think I was at Record Plant, my third visit, maybe third or fourth visit to Record Plant, resume in hand, to ask yet again if there was any openings. And I walked in, and behind the front desk, there was a woman screaming at a guy. I mean, just, she was quite upset, and she was, he had screwed something up. In his arms a bunch of, I don't know, groceries or something. And she was very upset. So she fired him there on the spot. She was so angry. She fired this guy. She's like, "You're fired. That's it. Get out." And she turns around and looks at me standing there at the front desk with my mouth hanging open. And she said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'm just new to LA and I'm looking for a job." And
what that guy's all job. Right.
She said, "When can you start right now?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "You're hired." And that's how I got my job working at Record Plant.
It's so funny because I feel like, was that did that feel like an exciting moment for you? Because I feel like there's a lot of folks that would look at that and see the manner by which the previous guy is getting fired and think, "Oh, hell no, do I want to work here?" But I was always wired in a way that's like, you know, I don't know, there's a certain amount of masochism that I just accept, I think, and say, "Bring it on." I mean, it's still, it's a hell of a moment to just kind of go, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that, I think it's partly that. It's partly like, you know, sure, you know, why not? Part of it's desperation for a job, you know, no lie. It's, you know, at some point you're just kind of like, I need the job. And there's also this, this feeling like, you know, I can do the job. I don't know what that guy, I don't know what his, right, his issues were and whether he deserved it or not. I don't know. But I think I won't know until I try. So, you know, I think I was just, yeah, I was dumbfounded on one hand and just, you know, super excited the next, because the next moment, you know, I'm walking through the doors and going back and going into the recording studios and seeing Record Plant and the inside for the first time. And thinking to myself, "Oh yeah, this is right. This is where I'm supposed to be." So, yeah.
And you obviously over the subsequent years, the number of types of folks you got to work with is pretty incredible.
I did get to work on some very exciting things, and I got to see some amazing music being made, you know, by some amazing musicians. So that was great. I enjoyed that. I did that for, I don't know, 5 years, something like that. And I just started kind of burning out, honestly. And I saw friends of mine in the industry who were also burned out. I specifically had one friend who was a 15 years older than I was, who was a recording engineer doing some amazing records. And I was sitting in the studio with him one day, and he was on the phone with his manager, just desperate to know what his next job was, what his next gig was going to be. And and this was after a couple of records that were really hard that I worked on that were just kind of demoralizing a bit. And I just looked down the console at him. I saw him on the phone and overheard this, and I was like, I can't. This can't be me. I'm not really cut out for that. I'm not. That's really not what I'm.
Specifically, the kind of unending grind of it. You mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, I got to work with some amazingly successful recording engineers. You know, I got to second engineer for Bob Clearmountain, and I got to, you know, just lots of guys, you know, just lots of your big talent. And those guys were in this echelon where, you know, they were in demand. They were always getting calls, you know. Right. But then there's everyone else who, you know, it's the bread and butter of the industry. There's, you know, maybe you can get to that spot and maybe you can't. But for me, it was just a moment of deciding whether I was prepared to try to be or not. You know, am I still prepared to kind of try to keep climbing this ladder and get to that point? Do I think I have the talent? Do I have the stamina? And for me, it just didn't ring true as being, you know, really what my heart's desire was. I guess I didn't want that bad enough, but I wanted other things. And I started to kind of explore, what do I really want to do? And I was always a closet hacker. So I was always, I probably had Commodore Amiga 1000 serial number 10 or something.
Wow.
I don't know that that's much of an exaggeration. I got one really early, and I just was into doing that on the side.
How did that then come onto your radar? Sorry to interject, but just sure. how did it come across your desk, as it were, that you could be on it as such an early adopter?
Well, I was, I went to school, you know, my high school, my middle school were pretty progressive, and they had computers there, and I got into computers at that point. And when it came time to buy my own computer, it was the Macintosh and the Amiga were the kind of two things. Amiga was just coming out, it had a lot of promise. The Amiga was just coming out, lots of promise there. The Mac had been out a little bit, you know, longer, and I needed to make a decision, and I, for some crazy reason, decided Amiga, which on one hand looks like the wrong choice if you wanted to actually make music at the time, because there were all kinds of issues with those early Amigas and trying to make music and stuff. But in retrospect, it actually worked out very well for me, because anything I wanted the Amiga to do, I had to make it do it myself. So there was a lot of like learning how to, you know, I knew a little bit about programming before I got the Amiga. I learned a lot about programming when I got the Amiga, because it was like, well, if I wanted this thing to do anything, the software is not, you know, the availability of software isn't great. So I got the Amiga, and I toyed around with that through college and when I got to Hollywood. And honestly, it actually helped me when I got into the recording studios, or it helped me get into the recording studios, because at the time, consoles were, you know, were getting more and more computerized. I wouldn't say that I was like necessarily like there for the first generation of computerized consoles, but it was pretty early on for SSLs, and Neves had GML automation. And so I was working with, there were a lot of engineers coming through the doors while I was a second engineer, before that, even while I was still a gopher and helping out the tech department, who really didn't know how these systems worked. And right. So but I was super excited to learn about them. So I dug into the books, and I knew everything about how the SSL worked and how our GML automation worked, and like pretty quickly, because I was just super interested in that. So, you know, I would dig into those manuals and play with them all the time. So I ended up getting called into studios a lot to help, you know, help get things set up for mix dates and stuff like that.
I think there's a lot to kind of internalize about that. I mean, I just saw the other day, our colleague who you surely know, Bradley Meyer at Sucker Punch, listed job posting for their internal audio department, who needed that, you know, that classic game audio unicorn of essentially a savvy audio programmer who, you know, who can handle integration and things like that, but can also get into the code. And it seems like, you know, I don't know that you tell me if in those days that you're describing, the value of somebody could even be truly appreciated who could walk both of those paths a bit. But now if you have the combined skill set of that sort of thing, it's just like you're instantaneously the most in demand person, it would seem like, in this business, because there's so precious few who can handle the engineering and can be fluent in music, and, you know, understand a session and all that kind of thing, which can pay dividends with integration and, you know, WISE and FMOD and all that end of it. But actually, you know, get under the hood on the code and not be lost immediately.
No, it's true. I think, you know, if you look at my career and the success I've had has been primarily because I was, because I could straddle this, you know, divide, if you will, between kind of the creative and the technical, although I hate to describe it that way. I feel like the technical is creative as well. What do I want to call it? Content creation and technical implementation. I don't know.
No, I think I get what you mean. The spirit of it, it's all fundamentally creative, but yeah. I get the delineation still is helpful.
Sure. So, you know, I think I feel like that very early on when I got into the game industry, I knew what I wanted, what I needed to do. I was charged with, you know, I was brought on board to Sony and I was charged with, you know, building recording studios and hiring staff and figuring out how to make these new games for PlayStation 1 because it was going to have amazing audio and how do we make these things sound like movies sound and those kinds of things were great aspirations at the time. And
this was like 96 or so, something like that.
Yeah, I started with Sony the January before PlayStation launched in the US. So it was, there were still not complete development kits in the US yet. So I knew what I needed, what the tools that I needed to create the content I was being asked to create.
Yeah.
And the staff that I was hiring sound designers and stuff. And I knew the tools that they would need. And when I went around looking for those tools, they didn't exist. It isn't so much on the side of, you know, audio recording and sampling. You know, we could use Pro Tools as it existed at that point and Sound Designer and various pieces of software. But this is the implementation / integration tools. You know, how do I actually put the sound in the game? It was like, okay, I was just shocked to find out that a producer was going to come to me who had clearly a lot more experience than I did and give me a Excel spreadsheet with a list of sounds in it. And I was supposed to like give them a corresponding wave file to go to with each one. And I was just shocked. I was like, this can't be the way I do it. Yeah. I can't ever, you want one crash sound. Wouldn't that crash sound get, won't that get old after a while? You know, there's gotta be a better way to do this. So
this is all just essentially your intuitive take then on the, just reacting, coming in, I guess, with somewhat of an objective kind of fresh perspective as someone who hadn't been living with the iterations up to that point. Or was it something, I'm phrasing this badly, but I'm just trying to wrap my head around how you could see so clearly what the needs were with, because sometimes it's easy to kind of, you know, it's the forest and the trees problem where when you're in a thing, you don't actually realize what would substantially change your quality of life in tackling these problems.
Well, in some ways, that's where, you know, my background in quote unquote traditional media came into play. You know, I had done in college and a little bit after that, I'd done a little bit of sound design. I had friends who were sound designers for movies and television, and I knew how that job was done. And when I came into games, I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, how different could it be? You know, I need to... I need to do what a sound designer does. And, you know, again, I saw the production methodologies and the, you know, the specifications for the content in theory that I was supposed to deliver. And I thought to myself, well, I can't really do the sound designer's job in this case, because what we really need to do is put the sound designer needs to be in the box. You know, what I need is an expert system that understands what sound designers understand. And I'm not going to put in one crash sound from your spreadsheet. I'm going to put in a bunch of little pieces of things that make up a crash sound, maybe 10 of them. And then I'm going to dynamically mix them every time we want a crash sound. And this way it will sound different every time we need a crash sound. You know, to me, it was just applying the model that I understood to games. And honestly, you know, it worked for me to great advantage. there were a few cases where it didn't work well for me and were great learning moments. I remember making a game very, very early on with David Jaffe. And he was working on a top-down shooter. And I created a bunch of sounds for him. And he came back to me and he said, you know, there's something wrong with this sound when this thing happens. I don't even remember what the thing was. But so he came over and we're playing it. And he's like, finally, it occurs to him. He's like, yeah, you know what it is? It's that it sounds different every time. And I thought, oh, well, isn't that a good thing? And he then showed me, he's like, in this case, no. Because the sound is going to, you're going to get to know that sound. And when you hear that sound, it's going to be just as much of a cue as the visuals. So you wouldn't want the visuals to change every time this thing happens. So we don't want the sound to change either. Every time they hear that sound, it should trigger a response. Like, and it was like, oh, you know, once we got to that point, it was like, oh, of course, you know, like I'm not doing a movie. I'm, you know, this isn't a television show. This was, you know, quite an, you know, a new thing for me. I hadn't really thought about it that way up to that point. And luckily it was very early on in my Sony career when this happened. So.
No, those kinds of things are so interesting. There's definitely musical equivalents to that kind of thing that have come up in the past for me as well, especially with regard to, you know, how light of a touch or not to put into interactive music design, you know, with just that question of, you know, some players, especially if they are long, lifelong, you know, nostalgia ridden gamers, the idea of just a static linear piece of music that's looping is to them, that's definitive of the video game music experience, you know, especially if you're playing a lot of these sort of Japanese RPG type titles where it's really just, here's your 2 minute, you know, boss fight music. And to them, dynamic music that sort of evolves or tries to sidestep the fatigue that can be so inherent to that is actually like anathema to the gaming experience. And I always, that always has bothered me because I think, yeah, but, but like, the way those loops and things, that's a tradition because there wasn't really much alternative at the time. Like that, that was, you know, a pure necessity at the time. But it is, so yeah, it is interesting how games kind of take on there's vocabulary that starts to kind of make them play by a different set of rules than some hypothetical equivalent in film and TV.
No, it's true. But I would also say, you know, just as you're describing these situations where people people have expectations of hearing a certain thing, maybe repeated. I feel like I've never felt like there hasn't been room to still kind of push the art in like other directions or find those opportunities. It kind of got the creative juices flowing because it's in some ways, you know how they say, you know, you reduce the size of the canvas and the color palette, and then all of a sudden, you know, your limitations force you to come up with interesting solutions. So
absolutely, yes.
I think there's time and place for everything, right? So if I built very early interactive music system at Sony for the first games I made there with a guy named Chuck Dowd, who's just a monster.
Oh, yeah.
He works at Sony.
The guy that gave me my literal first ever job.
That's awesome. I love Chuck. Chuck and I went to college together, and he was one of my first hires at Sony.
Oh, no kidding.
And we're close friends, but
you hired him.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't ever know that. That makes you like my professional godfather, I think. Because I honestly, Chuck is literally the guy who was the gatekeeper to me getting my first ever professional industry job, which was on Flow. Because I'll never forget, he asked me who my representation was, and I lied to him and said, oh, well, I'm kind of between reps at the time. I was an undergrad student at USC, and I thought if he knows that, I won't get the job. He was very, you know, he later found out and he was very cool about it. But anyway, not to derail you, but that's funny. I had no idea because Chuck is definitely kind of, you know, he's inseparable at this point from what Sony's been doing for the last 20 years.
Oh, the stuff I used to ask Chuck to do. I mean, when the first interactive music system that I wrote with Chuck required him to hand enter system exclusive messages into, I think he might've been using Cubase at the time, or maybe it was Logic at one point. So I came up with this system that allowed us to do a couple of different types of dynamic music changes, and it was all MIDI playing, you know, the sound chip on the PlayStation. And But to control it, I had, you know, before I wrote the tool, there was just a data specification. And so he had to hand write all of this system exclusive messages. And so I would walk into his office / studio, which was right across from mine. And he just had covering the walls, these giant pieces of paper that had like all these complicated drawings about how the music would move. And underneath them, all of these like cryptic, like list of numbers that he was like, okay, this is what I have to type into the box that I open
like
up.
Like a beautiful and, mind.
You know, to make happen. Yeah, it was just insanity. But he did some amazing work. That was we did some of it on a game, a little known game called Captain Blasto, but primarily the most of the work happened on this game called Siphon Filter for PlayStation 1.
Ah, yeah, right. Was this because it was an interactive, like this was essentially just the way that you were creating the interactive audio? Because obviously you could be playing back audio to some degree, but if it's interactive system, this was the method by which you kind of implemented that?
Yeah, exactly. So I built a system that, I mean, to this day, it's kind of the way I have yet to find a much better approach to kind of thinking about this stuff. But I'm always interested in hearing more. So maybe you'll know some and teach me some things about doing the interactive music. But the way
I was banking on you teaching me. So let's see what happens.
The way I thought about it and the way that, you know, from a musical standpoint, and this again comes back to where my musical background really helped me a lot. It's like, We want the music to change, but it has to happen musically. So what are the kind of things that change in music that make it interesting? You know, like, okay, well, there's a certain amount of complexity is changes are interesting, you know, and that could be, you know, percussion sounds that, you know, become, start playing in a smaller subdivisions or they, you know, there's things get busier, things get more interesting that way. And then there are also times that are like big changes. Like and those things can happen actually. Those going back to the first kind of group of things, those things can happen pretty quickly and subtly in like ways that can happen almost immediately, right? Like if you're listening to a piece of music, it could be, you know, there may be musical moments where it makes sense. Like you might not want to just do it on any moment, but you might want to do it like on any given downbeat, something could happen or every quarter note or every 16th note, as long as it's rhythmic, you know, some of those things could creep in. But then these are bigger changes, right? There's these bigger changes that require kind of I think of it as a sectional change where it's like, oh no, right. Now we need some kind of big buildup and then boom, we hit a thing, you know, and it's like a musical moment that's like big and lots of things change. So I came up with this system that we used that allowed us to kind of embed MIDI into this, you know, the MIDI that we were playing back that I was able to monitor and code and see Chuck was able to mark up places in the score where there were musically relevant places to turn on and off tracks.
Right.
So you could think of like a percussion shaker or something. Like it's like, okay, we can set that up as a repeater and say like it's musically relevant on any eighth note to turn on the shaker track.
Presumably catalyzed by some kind of game event, some game state change or whatever.
Right. So we can decide, we'll figure out later about, well, I'll come to like what triggers that, but we could just start by categorizing the shaker as this is a thing we can turn on or off on any given eighth note, let's say. But we could think of like a guitar. So let's like think of a solo, like or an instrument playing a melodic line. It's like there's a little phrase and then there's a few beats of silence and then there's a little phrase and then a few beats of silence or a quarter of silence and a phrase. Those phrases may not always be the same length. They might not always be two bars long. They might be six beats long and then a four beat long. And then, so those we wouldn't set up as a repeater. We would say on this track, it's a musically there are three musically relevant moments that it could be turned on or off. And they are at these positions between the phrases. So we could mark those and say, these are logical places where this could turn on or off. So once we had these tracks that we understood could turn on or off at a given musical moment, the code would just wait for, at any given musical moment, it would look at the tracks of music and say, what tracks of music are allowed to be turned on or off at this moment? And so we have a list and say, okay, well, the shaker could be turned on or off, et cetera. And then it would look and say, okay, well, this, and here was another piece of authoring. Chuck would then go through and say, okay, the shaker, I want it to be on when the quote unquote excitement is above 100. And I want it to be off when the excitement is below 100. And so this code would look and say, okay, well, the shaker can be on or off. Okay, great. Well, what's the criteria for it being on or off? The excitement needs to be above 100. Okay, turn it, is the excitement above 100? Yes, turn it on. And so for each of these tracks with their markup about when they can turn on or off, there's also some criteria that says what allows them to be on and what requires them to be off. So that would handle the very like quick interactivity, right? So you'd be in some battle or fight and it would be like little things turning on and you're getting all of a sudden the percussion would get more intense and things, and that stuff would just turn on. And it was sometimes very subtle, you know, it's like, but it was cool. And then we had these the second category of changes with these big like sectional changes. And he was able to mark up moments in the score where it's like, here are places in the music in general where it's okay to transition out of this current section. And each of those positions would have like, you know, if you this is a place where we can get out of this section, but if you get out of the section here, you need to first go through this transition B. And then from there, you can go to whatever you decide to go to next. So, you know, there was a lot of markup he could do about when it was okay to like, to take a transition out into a different section of the music completely.
It's amazing how this is all fundamentally unchanged to this day. Yep. I mean, it really is. All the things that I do day in, day out are as you describe here, but thank God, slightly less tedious to execute. I mean, it's amazing. I'm actually amazed to be discovering, I'm almost ashamed that I'm discovering this in this moment, that the degree of granularity and the fidelity of these kinds of, you know, real time interactivity on behalf of the music was, you know, in there right out of the gate on PS1. It's one of those things that I think of as, I think of the preponderance of game music being pretty, you know, sort of linear in quotes, by and large, you know, still pretty thoroughly at that point. I still think of people essentially authoring tracks, quote unquote, and looping bits and having stingers and or, you know, cutscene cues and calling it a day. And it's really not until 10 years later that you're talking about that it starts to become more normal. But you're making me think maybe there was a nuance I wasn't aware of.
Well, there's also, you know, the thing to consider about is, you know, or the thing to think about is that not everyone had access to these tools. So this was another challenge. So we had this system very early on. And after the first couple of games, Chuck actually finally got a tool that he didn't have to type in system exclusive. He was able to load up his MIDI in a, you know, nice GUI tool on the Mac and, you know, put markers in where things could change. And, but we would go to GDC at the time, which was obviously a much smaller thing than it has become.
Right.
And, you know, we would give talks once in a while and show this thing that we were doing. And it was just like, we would get inundated with people, you know, ask, how do I get these tools? How do I need to do this on the game I'm working on? And it was, unfortunately at the time it was, well, you kind of can't because we're, you know, first party Sony, this is a proprietary thing. But the reason we're having this discussion here is because we feel like the techniques that we're using could be done by anybody. And we weren't shy about talking about how we were doing what we were doing and like what the techniques were as far as, you know, turning the tracks on and off and how we were doing the markup. And the goal of talking about it at GDC was to try to inspire, since I couldn't share the tools, it was like, can we inspire any other companies or people or programmers or whatever to take on the task of doing it at their company, you know? So it was like, you know, well, you know, we get approached by so many composers who we would tell like, well, go make sure that the coders you're working with at your next on your next game, steer them to this GDC talk and ask them to go back and check it out, because, you know,
still, what a tall order. I mean, it's like, hey, we've just built, you know, the Ark of the Covenant. Go get one of those of your own. You know, everybody should have one of them. I mean, it just seems like it's such a far, you know, classic, easier said than done to just you know, ask the coders to give you our, like, to try and figure out what we've done. I mean, because, you know, you're talking about years of R&D and troubleshooting and, you know, all that, I would think.
And we took a lot of, you know, I spend of, you know, some amount of time on various committees/boards trying to, you know, with the MIDI Manufacturers Association and the IA-SIG and various groups that existed over the years in discussions about, you know, can we, you know, talk about whether we could come up with some standards. And with the idea being, if we came up with some standards, maybe the DAW manufacturers would latch onto it and they would make us some tools and we would start to see some of the things, the GUI tools that the composers want and need to do this kind of work would appear there. And then if that happened and there was a standard, then we could, you know, turn back to the game companies and the console manufacturers and say like, hey, look, there's this, can we get some libraries and even third party, right? Because there's the whole, middleware concept was like, well, maybe then maybe a middleware company could come along and provide some middleware to do it.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that from Sony's perspective, it represented a form of competitive advantage, where it was like the idea of even middleware is kind of like seeding ground in a way that would be undesirable, I would think.
You know, what was interesting is I think that I tried to kind of keep this under the radar a little bit. I'm not going to say that I did anything necessarily wrong at Sony, but I think, when I would have conversations, if
it's okay, we're in the cone of silence here. No one other than however many thousands of people will hear your confession.
And I haven't worked at Sony for 13 years or something. So
statute of limitations.
Yeah, there you go. It's got to be up now. I would have conversations with the management there about some of these talks that I would give. And, I always thought this is, to their credit, I always got permission to talk about this stuff. I always felt like this is not our competitive advantage, the fact that we have interactive music. Better interactive and adaptive music in the industry is going to be better for the industry. Our whole goal here is to make games better and better and more and more like movies and more, more immersive. And that, if that happens, then the console manufacturer will sell more consoles. It wasn't hard to explain why we should share, if not the code for this, why we should share at least the, conceptually talk about the things that we've done and kind of how we approached them and what we did. So, to Sony's credit, I was always given permission to do that. I think amazing. A lot of the time that there was a real challenge getting kind of standards going. Where I'm sorry to say it, but those of us that were on the in the group of people that were doing it were very busy, right? So really, it really came down to a time dedication thing where it was like, okay, well, somebody, there's a few of us really doing this to a large degree or to, at a certain level. And we probably have the most to say about things that you could do to standardize it, but we can't be the ones responsible for actually organizing the effort to standardize them because I've got, I'm responsible for shipping audio on 20 games in the next 6 months. So I have to, I have to focus.
Is the, just as a slight side question, but is the work that you were talking about in those early PS1 days, did that lead to, is Scream a product of that?
Yes. So Scream was my sound effects side of that music tool. So the music tool isn't Scream's. Music tool was separate. Scream was something I created, again, very early on, around the same time Scream started development, for very similar reasons. And they shared some underlying kind of concepts and they the idea being that I wanted to create these tools that let sound designers create lots of data that they could make be kind of dynamic, reactive, interactive, whatever word you want to use, mm-hmm. with as little programmer input as possible, with the, right. without the need to ask a programmer to do some work,
which is massive. I mean, that's like, just for anybody who kind of hears this, who doesn't quite realize the sort of infinite value of not having to hit up programmers for support. That is the constant bottleneck for game audio people. So self-sufficiency is worth its weight in gold.
I could point out that before it was called Scream, it was called 989 Sound. 989 SND was the name of the library. And it got its name Scream because the very first game developer conference, actually it was a Sony-specific game developers conference that Sony threw, they asked me to present this thing. And they said, what's the thing? You should present your audio engine at this talk, at this conference. And I said, okay, well, I can come and talk about 989 Sound. And this guy, a guy named Brett Modulewski, who worked in the third party group, came to me one day and said, that's a terrible name. And we shouldn't put that on the you know, list of who should, you know, of the, what the, you know, the conference talks are. But I have a better idea. We should call it SCREAM, which stands for Scriptable Engine for Audio Manipulation. And I was like, sold.
Wow, I never knew that history. That's hilarious.
So that's what SCREAM means, Scriptable Engine for Audio Manipulation. Yeah, so, you know, the very early on, there was a killer, the killer app, if you will, the killer demo of SCREAM was this one that I ended up using like all the time whenever I needed to show a sound designer how to use it or show a team why they should use it, which is I would play this sound with it. You know, you could audition sounds with this tool and, you know, you'd play a sound and it would be this jungle sound and you would hear birds chirping and you'd hear monkeys screeching in the background randomly and all the stuff is happening in stereo or in surround. And then you would move the mouse over and click on the gunshot sound and you'd click on the gunshot and you hear bang. But at that same moment, you'd hear all this flapping of all the birds and they would all fly away. Yeah. And the monkeys would screech and they would go silent and it would become all of a sudden quiet, except for the crickets. And if you just sat there and waited for, you know, a minute or two, all of a sudden the birds started to come back and you'd hear a bird chirping again here or there and the monkeys. And so I would show you like, yeah, there's zero programmer effort to make the birds fly away or the monkeys go away because the gun sound internally to the way that the gun sound is authored has this markup in it that says, hey, when this plays, it's a gunshot. And then the ambient sound of all the birds playing has a thing that says like, hey, if there's a gunshot playing, then we need to, you know, do this other thing. We need to branch over to this other kind of.
It's so huge.
So it's much like, you know, this thing that we talked about with the music. It was like, oh, you can branch, you can mute things, you can unmute things, et cetera. Like what causes them to mute or to branch or to, and how do I make it so that I can have these messages going back and forth way down at the audio level if I can't get a programmer to kind of go in and mark up or a sound or a game designer, you know, go markups levels or markup, you know, geometry or markup animations. There's a lot I could do with just that scripting ability in the audio engine. So. Yeah, we did a ton of that stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think it's just so incredible to be able to, like, that moment. I, again, I'm very spoiled because, you know, kind of by the time my career was off and running, some of these tools were more or less a given, or they were, if not a given, they were within reach. And so it's just thrilling to picture kind of that moment of, you know, the kind of the before times and the after times of that degree of self-sufficiency and the ability to kind of daisy chain sort of logical consequences to certain things so that all you really need is just the one input, the one state change or the one variable or whatever from the game to then set off a whole chain reaction. I mean, just the artistry that enables is so exciting.
It's interesting. The interesting thing I found with SCREAM, I think this is an ongoing issue. I see it, you know, I'm not at Sony any longer. So, you know, but I work with sound designers who are working with FMOD and I've worked with sound designers who are using WISE. I feel like I see this kind of regardless of the underlying tool set. There really are technical sound designers and non-technical sound designers. Mm. And you can't make a judgment about the, you know, artistry of either category because there are some amazingly talented sound designers who create amazing sounding things who are not technical sound designers.
Right.
And the same is true of technical sound designers. There are plenty of them that can make great sound and some of them that can't. But this does require a way of thinking about your audio. It's like we talked about earlier where with the tools, what kind of tools would I need to make sound, music, sound effects, et cetera, in this game, since I'm coming into this from a different industry, I don't see the tools here that I need. Well, it turns out that the tools that you need are different enough from the tools that you need for doing linear traditional media that you have to dedicate yourself to learning them. You know, it's almost like an instrument. And some people are more you know, adept at it. And some people are more interested in doing it. So You know, it can be sometimes a challenge to find those technical sound designers who really want to, again, the other thing we talked about is straddling these two different areas. It's like, they don't need to be programmers. So they don't have to make, maybe their straddle is not quite as wide, right? Maybe the gap they have to straddle is not as wide where, you know, they have some technical chops and some, you know, enough technical chops to do some scripting, maybe not some C++ programming and maybe not some DSP programming, but they understand enough about logic and they can, you know, come up with some simple, you know, logic puzzles and things to put into scripts. But also are very creative and have good ears and understand like how to create great sounds. But not everyone has that, right? So it's, we found that at the beginning, and I think it's still true today, that there are, that people that can really take this up and move the ball down the field, you know, but there are some that can't. And you probably, if you have any staff at all, you probably want both, you know, you need a mixture of all of the above, but you kind of can't go without somebody who, if you want to make a great sounding game, at some point, you're going to have someone, you're going to need a technical sound designer and a technical music editor, right? Though I think about the same thing. Chuck and I used to have these conversations all the time. It's like, well, we're missing music editors in the games business. They exist in the film business. What do? They just chop music? Well, okay, yeah, but they also know some things about music and they understand. And we have even a more challenging technical process that we need to use to get music into the game. So if we want to use composers who are used to composing for traditional media, for linear media, and they're not used to composing interactive scores, what does that mean? Does that mean that we can only ever use composers who do learn all of that stuff? Or is there a way we can shepherd composers through a process of creating content such that a music integration engineer, or, you know, I don't know what title we give them, but we also have people who are very musical, who are also very technical, and they could really help drive the implementation of the music in the game.
Well, it's needless to say, that's kind of, I think, become the creative services group's claim to fame over the last 10 yeah. years or so, you know, is the ability to, the number of composers that have scored, you know, like we could say zeitgeist-defining scores. They have written these really, you know, sort of emblematic scores of kind of the state of the art, who have no prior experience in games, as aided by specifically the kind of process that you were laying the foundation of. You know, whether it's like Gustavo Santaolalla on The Last of Us and you know, onward from him, there's a lot of composers that have benefited from this, you know, unbelievably. And I think the art, it's just like you were saying about raising the tides for kind of the industry in general, that it's better for everybody when these things, you know, happen. I think that the art form has benefited from the diversity of voices, because I definitely think, you know, in the oldest days of the game industry, you know, 40 years ago or 30 years ago, when the only shot at being a composer was essentially to just be some person on the team, probably a programmer who happened to also kind of have a side gig as a musician. And so all music kind of felt like, it's overwhelmingly not being written by people that live and breathe music 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And the industry, the democratization that's been able to be possible because of these tools that you're talking about, that allowed for specialists to come in who don't necessarily know every last thing there is to know about how it all works, but they can contribute their specialty. It seems like just the impact has been unbelievable.
I think that's true. And I think I want to say, you know, I've been talking about a lot about, you know, I was working on this and I was working with Chuck and Chuck did these things. And the thing I think is worth pointing out here too, though, is even more than today, and I don't think that it's necessarily horrible today, but the amount of information we would all share was, you know, it was just awesome. I mean, there was a time, I am friends with this guy named Brian Schmidt. Now, Brian Schmidt and I worked together before I was in the game industry. We worked together for a technology company that had a technology used in the recording studio. And I was the field engineer who would train other recording engineers how to use this technology. And Brian worked for the company as well. And he was, I think, employed to try to find opportunities to exploit this technology in the game industry. Anyway, Brian and I have a history that goes way back.
This is the same like Game Sound Con, Brian.
Yep. So Brian
Amazing.
And I knew each other well. I left that company and I went to work for Sony. And a year or two later, Brian left that company and some of his other freelance work that he did, and he became the head of audio at Microsoft. So there were many GDCs with the head of Microsoft audio development and the head of Sony first-party product development, audio development, could be found sitting in some side area of the GDC conference space or at a bar across the way, having these great conversations about things that we wanted to do, ideas that we had, that, you know, things that we tried that didn't work very well. You know, I don't know that our employers would necessarily be all that upset about it, but I have a feeling that they would have definitely questioned it.
What a perfect representation. That's, I love that though. What an absolutely amazing little snapshot of why GDC in particular is not only so special, but it's one of those things that it's always my go-to example of the thing that makes the game industry different from any other industry. There is no film industry equivalent where, you know, like at Sundance or at the Oscars or something, you know, Spielberg and Scorsese or maybe even their, you know, the, like you said, the head of the audio or the music or sound design department at Warner Brothers is going and having drinks with this person and just kind of saying, you know, so what kind of toys are you working on? I've got some toys I wouldn't mind sharing with you, that kind of thing. Like that, there's just no equivalent to that in any other industry. I love that little image of you and Brian that I did not know existed.
I feel like we've always been the great thing about this this space where you're merging kind of the all of this creative energy and this technical know-how and your experience is that your value is has very little to do with what you have already done. So we go to the GDC conferences and we talk about, well, here's this, you know, how we did the music for this game that we released 6 months. And in the back of your head, you could, you know, some people would be, oh, you're sharing, you know, top secret stuff. And I'd be thinking, if they start today to build the stuff so that they can create audio like the audio that we had on a game we shipped 3 months ago, well, when they have that done, we will have our next level of stuff done. And that's not that, you know, that's not going to be a problem. And the benefit of it is that other people are doing the same thing. You know, it's like you're getting, this is an, there is quid pro quo here, or there is, you know, there is this sharing where you kind of is, does go back and forth where you, I'd go to you know, these. So yeah. So the point was I would meet with Brian, right? Where I would, you know, there were a lot of people interested in this area and I would go to GDC just, you know, dying to hear some, I felt like I could always go and get one or two ideas that pop into my head or that would be just explicitly explained by someone where I thought like, I never thought of it that way. Like it never would have occurred to me to like, oh, I should, yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if I can, how could I take that and apply it to the way we do this kind of thing? And, oh, can I go back and write some code that does X, Y, or Z? And the same thing would happen, I know, to, you know, to Chuck and to the rest of the staff. We would all come back after GDC and be like, oh, you know, someone has a tool that can do this and someone has a tool that can do that. And these guys did approach it this way. And how could we do that? Well, you know, we could figure out like how to take that, merge it with our own ideas. Yeah, it's, that's a lot of fun. I've missed GDC. You know, COVID has resulted in me missing the first GDCs. I think prior to COVID, I'd been to every GDC since 1995, I think. And so, yeah, I've missed GDC.
Yeah, it is such a, I always joke that that week at GDC was always like the recharge that I needed in order to make it through the following 51 weeks. Cause it was absolutely, you know, the equivalent of a kid going to summer camp right up to it, including the idea of having camp friends that you always see that week. And so you look forward to it cause you know, this is basically the one shot I'll see them until the following year. And, so yeah, boy, do I resonate with that. Well, I have about 15 minutes before I have to jump. Unfortunately, this is all so just absolutely incredibly fascinating. But I want to talk, obviously now, as you mentioned, you left Sony and now you're at Harmonix, which is in so many ways sort of the epicenter for the forward thinking development of just how to play with music as a variable in gameplay, I would say. I mean, you know, what drew you over there? Because in hindsight, like, just the more I hear you talk and then kind of taking a wide view of your career, it almost seems like an inevitability, because they're sort of the go-to for these kinds of experiments, it would seem. But what kind of did it?
Well, I think that, you know, I loved my time at Sony, and it was very hard to leave. And to, you know, a great degree, I missed being at Sony for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the people who I love there. But there were, I had a lot of reasons why I had to leave. And they involved like everything from my, you know, personal gratification I get out of the kind of work that I was doing to family matters. You know, I grew up on the East Coast and I, you know, I'm originally from here. My wife is as well. So there were some like family issues that being on the East Coast made easier to deal with. So there were a variety of things, but I had known Harmonix since, their very first console game for PlayStation, which was called Frequency, mm-hmm. because or was Amplitude first? I forget now which one was first, Frequency or Amplitude. That's sad. I was at Sony at the time that we put that out on the PlayStation, and because it was a music game, it was put out and produced by my studio. Sony has a studio system for game development. So I was running not only the sound group and a variety of technical service groups and the content creators on the sound side, but I had this little kind of boutique studio, and I would get thrown these games that were like, hey, here's a unique music thing, or a interesting iToy came out. It was released through my studio because it was kind of this unique controller. Anyway, so I knew the Harmonix guys very well and stayed in touch, you know, with them through the whole, you know, from going from, you know, doing the titles for us to doing Guitar Hero and everything else. So I knew them well. And, you know, the opportunity came to come over here. And honestly, initially I came over and I wasn't programming audio. And I was brought over and I would contribute to discussions about the technical direction we should take. But I had a more senior role and was a vice president of various technologies, online services and those kinds of things. So
like a more of a management role.
Yeah, it was more management, which was much like what I was doing at Sony when I left, and part of the challenge for me at Sony.
Needed your hands dirty, in other words.
It's kind of too late to make a long story short, but I got we kind of went through this period at Harmonix where I was kind of working my way toward kind of managing my way out of a job, because there was downsizing happening. And it was clear to me like, hey, this role there's really no reason to have someone doing the work that I do here at this company as it's reducing size. But before I went job searching, before I could even go job searching, the founders came to me, Aron Agosi and Alex Rogopoulos, and said, you know, how would you feel about programming again? And I said, well, I would love to do it, but there's certain things I would, you know, kind of need in order to do that. So we had this discussion, and God, I can't tell you how glad I am to have stepped back into programming and kind of out of the full-time 100% managing, you know, stuff. So I got to go back and pursue this passion, and was given kind of carte blanche to try to like approach technologies and to create some technology that we didn't even know how we would use them, you know, at the times that I was creating them. You know, when we were doing a game called Fantasia, mm-hmm. and, you know, we were trying to do some things with that, but I could kind of see, you know, if we need to be able to allow players to just like magically mash up music. Like why can't you take like any drum beat and any guitar part, any bass, and just slam them together? Why doesn't that just work? You know, it should just. So, I mean, the tech for Drop Mix and for Fuser.
You know, I was going to ask you about Fuser because, yeah, I mean, that is the pitch for Fuser. And I've been looking at that game a lot lately because, you know, my whole passion is in interactive music. And basically that sentence that you just said of, you know, well, why couldn't I just take this and take that? And and make them come together in some sort of coherent way. Fuser was the first one that I saw recently that I thought, you know, goddamned if that's not the, like, essentially the premise of the game itself. I mean, it's never mind it as a second order effect because of an interactive music system that's chasing some other kind of gameplay, but that is the gameplay. And it's very impressive.
I think one of the big challenges we have is about gameplay. Because there's this axis you want to pursue that's very satisfying, which is just empowering people to be creative, right? It's like, I just want to give people creative agency. It's like, you know, and so we would play when we were working on this Drop Mix, which was the predecessor to Fuser and was the physical game, right, with cards.
Yeah.
You know, we would play test that and people would play the game. The playtesters would play the games and they would, you know, we would ask them to play this and what do you think and do. But invariably, my favorite part of the playtest, and it happened almost every time, was that when that was done and they had done the stuff, people would gather around the board with hands full of cards and just start putting them down. And this was before we decided that we would have a studio mode, because it was just like, you know, they would just start putting them down and creating all these really crazy combinations. And many times someone would ultimately walk over to the light switch and turn the lights off. And the board had lights on it, right? So they would flash. And so we have these cases where people were having dance parties in our playtest room because there'd be like four people playing with the cards and there'd be three or four, you know, girls over in the corner dancing. And it was just wild. And it was just great. And it was so awesome, you know, so that was very gratifying. And you know, Fuser, we try to take it a little bit further. It's kind of the, I definitely trained my whole career, I think, to build the technology and the tools that we used to make those games, because I feel like we did a pretty good job, but we have some ideas of things we can even do better. But, you know, we did this thing where I think that people find it just kind of magical. Like, you know, you put a card down and, or you put a disc on a disc player and you hear the drums from some song that you hear on the radio. And then you grab a Lady Gaga disc and you put it down and all of a sudden you see her voice at a whole different tempo and a different key. And it just is, it just magically works. And you come up with these combinations that sound great. And that magic is, you know, as we know, is not magic at all, right? It's just a bunch of underlying technology and concepts for how to approach content creation and playback that came from years of doing it and working with great composers who have great ideas about things that they want to do or how they might approach some content creation, but they don't have the tools or they don't have the playback technology. And so, I'm really proud of that, those titles, and they were a ton of fun to create, you know,
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about Fuser, and he ended up spending hours and hours playing it. And when he came back, he had a really insightful takeaway from it where he said, you know what I really love about this is that it lets you can both be creative and it lets you make a bit of a mess. And he said that the fact that I didn't always feel like I had the bowling alley bumpers up and that it actually let me, like, creativity means getting in the mud occasionally. If you put every color from your palette on the canvas all on top, you end up with a kind of brown sludge after a while. And like, you don't really feel an earnest connection to the creativity unless that's an option for you, because then your achievement is a little bit more meaningful. And he was very appreciative of the fact that Fuser let you actually kind of create that level of mayhem, which I also think, as a side note, is a credit to the artists and labels and whatnot that actually, I think, license their material, knowing that basically, like, yeah, we're gonna put, you know, you work so hard on your mixes,
yep,
and we're gonna give people the opportunity to completely destroy them in the spirit of creativity, and that they went along with that. The whole thing is a pretty substantial victory, as far as I can see.
That's great to hear. We definitely. You know, there were definitely conversations about that. Should we allow people to put this with this? Because it might not sound great if there's, you know, here are the mode switches that will sound okay, and here are the mode switches that will not sound okay. You know, should we? And we finally came to the conclusion, like, no, like, let's just throw the stuff on there. Yes, you can, you'll never create something that's so horrible, that's like so dissonant, where or tempos are different or things are out of sync. But yeah, sometimes it will just not be all that interesting, or it won't, you know, things won't really fit nicely. But the nice thing is that once that there's the magic that happens when you kind of go from that and you swap out a few cards, And you can just as easily create something that you've never heard before and it sounds amazing. You're like, I never would have thought that if I took this Diana Ross drum thing and this Lady Gaga thing and this Stevie Nicks thing and this Hall & Oates thing and put them together that it would be cool, but it's crazy cool. It sounds so awesome. Or, you know, it's like where it actually turns heads. You know, you'd be walking by someone's office and you hear a set of cards down. You turn around and go like, what the hell is that? That is awesome. And you'd have to look and see what cards they had down. And not only that, you'd have to figure out what order they put them down in, right? Because depending on the order you put them down, you get a different tempo and a different key and a different mode. So it would be like, oh man, what were those cards and what order did you put them down in? That sounds great.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. And there's nobody, Harmonix really has always stood apart in that way. I remember I gave a talk at GDC once about, you know, adjacent subjects, and Aaron actually came up to me and gave me his card and was like, we should be friends because I think we're in alignment with each other in ways that you don't even realize. And it was kind of my awakening to just how much the sort of Harmonix is almost like a synonym for a mindset about audio more than it is a brand or a developer or publisher or whatever, you know, not publisher, but you know what I mean? Like a creator of games. Yeah. It is a way of thinking about game music or about music in general, just the idea of kind of letting the player in on the experience to one degree or another. I find it amazing. And I'm thrilled that you were able to kind of downgrade your title to a place that let you get your hands dirty, because it sounds just like, you know, perfect match. Yeah, I have to run in a moment, but I'm curious to ask you just as a parting words. I know this is I don't think I've ever actually done this on this show before, but it just because you're the one takeaway I feel like I could have from all of this is how forward thinking to the potential of the medium your whole career seems to have been. That seems to be a trait that has, you know, been very consistent for you. So to that end, where do you think all of this is headed? You know, what are the kind of hills that you're excited to broach next from a tech standpoint?
Yeah, and that's a tough question, but
I suppose the truest answer is probably covered by NDA.
Well, there's some of that, but I think to generalize it a bit, I think, I don't think it's any secret. And as you pointed out, like Harmonix's approach to this whole thing, you know, we see this challenge of trying to find this balance between the gamification of music and the, you know, unleashing the creative potential of our players and giving them some creative agency. And I think that what we learned from doing Fuser from a technical standpoint, or I should say what you know, but a few of us that had to deal with the technical issues from that, are that there's a lot more that we can, there's even more that we can do to make it interesting, to make it so that players can do more creative things in spaces where we can let those like bowling alley guardrails down a bit, but also bring them back, you know, but not take them all the way down so people can, you know, how do we let people create music without requiring the development of some monster technique, you know? So that's the kind of, I think the thing that stands in the way of a lot of people expressing their musical creativity is just the technique you need to acquire on whatever it is, whatever instrument it is. It's like, until you reach some level of proficiency, you're kind of stuck. And so really a lot of what we do is about how do we let people have a creative experience where we can lower that bar. Anyway, I think maybe I'm just rambling and saying words at this point, but I think we are just really trying to push the envelope there. I think we did a lot of things in Fuser, and we have a lot of ideas for things that we can do going forward to expand that space. So,
well, I can't wait to see what tumbles out of that.
I feel like there's no shortage of work out in front of me. I certainly have never gotten to a place in my career where I thought, oh, so now what am I going to do? Because I don't know what to do next because it's all done. I've always had kind of a list of things in that backlog, which is like, oh, well, you know, someday I'll get some time.
Yeah, I relate to that, but I think it's sort of vicariously nonetheless really thrilling and inspiring, honestly, to just hear someone that, you know, you're not, there's no even sort of hint burnout or stir crazy or kind of cabin fever with it all. You know, you sound like in my naive idealism, I've always felt like the game industry is perpetually in this state of rolling up its sleeves going, now we can really get to work. It's just because everything seems to open up 50 new channels. And it's, you know, it's just wonderful to hear that for someone in your position that's helped build so many of the platforms on which the rest of us are standing, that you equally feel that way. I just absolutely love hearing that.
Yeah, I feel like I found my spot. Like I said, you know, I'm getting back into programming. I found the joy of the work that I do, and can get into the flow state of doing it. And it's, you know, it's like anything, it's a job, but I definitely have done a lot of jobs where that wasn't true. And I did not relish, you know, getting into the office in the morning. And I have to say that Harmonix has afforded me an amazing opportunity, you know, honestly, because there's not a lot of companies that would let me ply my craft like I do here. There are some big companies that would, but, you know, I've got a pretty long leash as far as what I do and kind of what I'm allowed to pursue. So,
well, I look forward to buying you a drink at the next GDC. I long for a return to some semblance of a normal GDC experience, and it would be a real pleasure to knowing that, you know, because I think I've only missed one in the last 10 years myself, so it's funny to think that we really genuinely have crossed paths in ways that at least I was ignorant to, and so I look forward to rectifying that. But
absolutely, let's do it for sure.
In the meantime, thank you so much again for doing this.
I hope there's something in there that's usable. I feel like I blabbered on for quite a while. So.
No, that's the format, man. We let it roll. It'll be, you know, an hour and change of just listening to all this, and I'm absolutely thrilled. It's a real welcome change of pace, I think, from a lot of the prior ones, and again, I think it'll just speak for itself. So thank you again.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.